Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
This week, 50 years ago, Sean McBride became the first Irish recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. A founding member of Amnesty International, McBride was also a former chief of staff of the IRA and he was a government minister. Well, today we're going to look back at his extraordinary and controversial career with Diarmaid Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. You're very welcome.
Morning, Claire.
Thanks for being with us. So Sean McBride, born in 1904 in Paris, he was the son of Maud Gonne, of course, and John McBride, and they were people who were steeped in politics and radicalism, and he was brought up, wasn't he, in that tradition?
Brought up might be too generous in relation to what happened during his infancy, because the defining event of his infancy was his parents' separation.
Mm-hmm.
Maud Gonne was a remarkable woman, and you know, we'll talk about her separately at another stage. And she had decades of political activism behind her, and she had married John McBride, who was very much associated with the Transvaal Brigade, the Irish fighting with the Boers against the British in South Africa. And he carried that reputation, and they had met in Paris. And of course, Maud Gonne had a very wealthy background. She had been born in Surrey, originally the daughter of an English army captain. A very unusual union. Many of Maud Gonne's friends begged her not to marry John McBride. He was an alcoholic. He had a very difficult temperament, and they were from completely different backgrounds. But she went ahead with it anyway. And some of her biographers have suggested that she didn't really think she was marrying John McBride. She was marrying Ireland. It was very much a political union. And Sean was
romantic
born in
notions.
In romantic notions. But Sean was born in 1904. And by 1906, the separation trial caused a sensation. And there was an awful lot of gossip around it as well, because some of the details that started to emerge from these court proceedings were very damning in relation to his drinking. There were allegations of child molestation, of violence. And it really was the talk, not just of certain parts of Paris, but also of Dublin. Beyond. The Irish Independent referred to it as the Paris sensation. It did an awful lot of damage to Maud Gonne and her reputation. She was a very unconventional woman and a very independent-minded woman. But the details that began to emerge in this became very problematic. Sean was two at that stage. And the court case really hinged around the question of custody. And ultimately, Maud Gonne was granted custody of Sean. And that meant that Sean was to spend much of his youth in France.
Yeah, they stayed on in Paris, didn't they, for
they
a
did.
While?
They did. I mean, it was remarkable for Sean. I mean, she had extraordinary wealth. So there was financial independence there, which was crucial. And I mean, he would have been flying kites with W.B. Yeats on the beaches in Normandy. Roger Casement would have popped in for tea. Ezra Pound featured in his youth as well. He was educated by the Jesuits in Paris. It was very difficult for Maud Gonne to return to Ireland, because there had been a separate legal case by John McBride for libel, which established that he had domicile in Ireland. And if she came back, he could challenge the separation under British law at that time, which would have favoured the father mm-hmm. in relation to custody, as it did in those days. So she had to be trepidatious about returning to Ireland. But of course, you know, Sean does ultimately come back for periods in Ireland, and is then also educated partly in Ireland in Wexford with the Benedictine monks. But he didn't see much of his father, and he was often very reticent about this for understandable reasons. He said in a television interview later in his life that there was the occasional postcard and summer visit, but there's very little contact for obvious reasons.
So she was the big influence on him then?
Oh, she certainly was. But then 1916 changes everything. You know, John McBride stumbles across the Easter Rising. He's actually quite a marginalised character within republicanism at that stage, but he becomes involved in fighting.
But he was
by
only,
all accounts,
isn't he 14?
No, this is his father, Jean.
John McBride. But didn't he himself say that he was involved at a very young age?
You know, one of the issues around Sean McBride, I suppose, is the evasiveness around his earlier years, because he claimed he became involved in Sinn Féin politics in 1918. He would have only been 14 at that stage. He certainly lied about his age to join the IRA. He had joined the Fianna Éireann as a teenage Republican. But there are some problems, I think, there with the chronology. But the important thing about 1916, I suppose, was that Maud Gonne then decided that the history that she had with his father was to be obliterated. And the way she put it, his name is now sacred, and Sean can be proud of his father's name, because he is now, of course, an Irish 1916 martyr.
So the Paris sensation is gone.
Very
and
much.
Now we have a new history, and which was acceptable for her.
Yeah, and Morgan, of course, is the widow of the martyr, and he is the son of the martyr, and he was the only child, of course, of that marriage. So that's the heritage that he is carrying, and it's unsurprising, given his mother's focus, intense focus, on British misrule of Ireland, that he goes down that path. But again, we don't have that much detail in relation to his activities during the War of Independence. He claimed that he was involved in various ambushes, that he was active in Dublin with the IRA. He certainly became involved with Michael Collins, who he idolised, and he was a dispatch carrier during the Anglo-Irish Treaty negotiations. So he certainly is there on the fringes, and he does become involved in the Civil War and is imprisoned for much of the Civil War, because he ends up in the forecourts at the outset of the Civil War. And interestingly, Maud Gonne originally supported the treaty because she was very close to Arthur Griffith and some of those who were advocating for acceptance of the treaty. And there would have been a difference of opinion between herself and Sean at that stage. But ultimately, of course, Maud Gonne also became anti-treaty and became very active in the prisoners' cause. So you can see, even at a very early stage, on a young stage, the Sean McBride is very much going down that Republican path. But he also was enrolled as a student in UCD. He claimed studying law and agriculture, which would seem to be a very unusual mix.
Yeah.
But he didn't finish his studies because of what was going on at the War of Independence and Civil War. And he didn't really have a job at the end of it by the time he escaped in October 1923.
He didn't need one, did he?
Well, he didn't need one in the sense of, you're absolutely right that there was a financial independence there. But for a young man like that in the post-Civil War dispensation, where does he go?
Mm-hmm.
What does he do? And ultimately, of course, he remains involved in the IRA. Ultimately, he served very briefly as chief of staff of the IRA in 1936, but I don't think his heart was in it. He was often seen as quite an exotic and intellectual character who was quite different from some of those who were centrally involved in the IRA. He always spoke English with a pronounced French accent, and many people found him aloof and quite distant. And many didn't trust him, I suppose, because of that mixture and his background.
He was unusual, exotic, you know, in the context of who you're talking about there,
yeah.
The people who were involved.
He did resume his law studies, and he began to make a name for himself as a lawyer in criminal cases. He was particularly focused on internment and the Offences Against the State Act and the capacity and power of the government to intern Republicans, and develops quite a high profile as a result of that. But he parts ways with the IRA. He resigned in 1937 because, as far as he was concerned, once the new constitution was introduced, sovereignty was invested in the people.
Mm-hmm.
The oath of allegiance was gone. You could pursue your aims as a Republican through constitutional means. So that's a very important turning point.
Right. But I want to go back to 1927, because at that point, wasn't he charged with the murder of the Minister for Justice?
Kevin O'Higgins, yeah.
What
was detained, and he was briefly charged with the murder of Kevin O'Higgins. Now, you know, this was outrageous in many respects. He had a very solid alibi. There was a jam-making business in Roebuck House in Clonskey, which was where
his mother's house.
Yeah, his mother's house, and where ultimately became his house as well. And he was in Brussels on business for this jam-making business. And he met Brian Cooper, who
it's
was
all
a Parliament...
mad, isn't it?
Well, he was, an Oireachtas member and supporter of the government, who was able to vouch for where he was when Kevin O'Higgins was shot. So ultimately, they had to release him, but they kept him for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an example, I suppose, of the fallout from that assassination and the fingers that were being pointed at prominent Republicans at that time.
So then we jump forward, and you said he pursued his legal career, he's making a reputation for himself. So where does politics come into the picture?
Politics really comes in with disillusionment around Fianna Fáil and the Republican project. You know, he had mixed views, obviously, about Fianna Fáil. He did accept the 1937 constitution, as I mentioned. But he becomes involved and ultimately the leader of Clan na Pobaigte in 1946. And in many ways, they are repeating the message of Fianna Fáil in the late 1920s. You know, a more radical social and economic programme, greater state intervention. Clan na Pobaigte as a new political party are highlighting emigration. And he was elected as a member of the Dáil for Clan na Pobaigte.
So we will be more Fianna Fáil than Fianna Fáil?
Yes, but we will also be truer to the Republican path and the Republican project. And there was huge enthusiasm generated around the idea that they would have the capacity to actually replace Fianna Fáil as the leading political party. They fielded 93 candidates in 1948. And there were some predictions that they would sweep the country, but they overreached themselves. They only won 10 seats, but that was enough to prevent Fianna Fáil from gaining an overall majority.
So what happened? Why didn't they fulfil their potential? Did they not have the people on the ground?
They didn't have the people on the ground. They ran too many candidates. They got carried away with their own rhetoric as well. You've got to remember how well organised Fianna Fáil was, even after 16 years in power. I mean, they had that local machinery oiled so well. Fianna Fáil was still performing very solidly. But De Valera also tried to outfox them by calling the election when he did, reckoning that they wouldn't quite be ready for the challenge.
And they weren't, but they were disruptors, is that fair to say?
Yeah, but I mean, they also miscalculated, you know, in relation to our system. And it's very interesting to be talking about it now in relation to how people can maximise their vote. And how many candidates you should run in particular constituencies. So, you know, that was a miscalculation. But 10 seats, nonetheless, did mean that they now represented a significant bloc in Dáil Éireann. And, of course, they came together with the opposition parties, very unlikely bedfellows, to form the first coalition government or inter-party government. And there was Sean McBride at the centre of it, with no ministerial experience. He was regarded by some as quite sophisticated and international-minded because of his background. He was appointed Minister for External Affairs, but he didn't trust civil servants. He prevented Maurice Moynihan, the Secretary of the Government, from attending cabinet meetings because he didn't trust them. You know,
that's a good way to go about it, isn't it?
Of suspicion was there. And he had a very mixed record as Minister for External Affairs. You know, some of the civil servants in Ivy House were horrified at the prospect of this particular individual coming in. And he did have an inflated sense of what he could achieve as minister.
So tell me a bit more about what he was like then as a person, because we're getting hints now, you know, the English spoken in with the French accent,
yeah.
Not trusting civil servants. What was his temperament like?
Well, it depends who you ask.
Okay.
For those who were, for whom he was very dear, he was very charming. He was charismatic. He was an intellectual. He was energetic. He was industrious. But Robert Briscoe, who would have been involved with him as a young Republican, referred to him as an ardent patriot who was warped by ambition. And that's not an isolated assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the biographical material on McBride has been quite hostile in relation to his outsized ego. He certainly had a very fine welcome for himself, but also had a great confidence, which is an important thing in politics. But he was also very obsequious and deferential when it came to his dealings with the Catholic bishops. And even by the standards of the day, he was exceptionally
obsequious. I was thinking about this last night when I was reading about him, you know, and I was thinking, is it fair for us to judge him for that, you know, through the lens of 2024?
Well, it's not about judging him through the lens of 2024. I'm actually thinking about the lens of his own rhetoric about republicanism. He had been critical of the bishops in 1922 in relation to their pro-treaty stance, for example. And even when he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1974, when he gave his speech, he referred to the extent to which the Catholic Church had too often allied itself with those who were not protecting justice, with the establishment. But at the same time, in private, he was sending these letters to people like Cardinal Dalton saying that we will place ourselves at your disposal and do not hesitate to contact us in relation to any legislation.
Right, because his fallout with Noel Brown was based around deference to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and there was a pair of them in the sense that Noel Brown was a very difficult character as well. You know, he didn't have a monopoly on irascibility and he could be very self-serving and could often elide some uncomfortable facts when it came to his narrative of what happened. But the bottom line was Sean McBride went to bat for the bishops when it came to Noel Brown's attempts as Minister for Health to introduce his mother and child scheme.
So
for
what
free
was that? Are we saying then that was more about his personality clash with Noel Brown than it was about satisfying the bishops?
There's elements of both in it. There's no doubt about that. The correspondence between them, however, Noel Brown and McBride, was absolutely vitriolic. And gives you an indication in
the
party. They couldn't stand each other. But also there was a feeling on the ground in the party that McBride had got too preoccupied with himself and his own brief and was neglecting Clan na Poblachta's original mission. And of course, Noel Brown became a very inspirational character for many. But it was also humiliating, perhaps, for a party that had presented itself as a radical, socially progressive alternative. And they got battered in the 1951 general election as a result, where they only came back with two seats.
Okay, well, let's move on then to after politics, because he became a major international figure in areas like peace and justice, didn't he, after 61?
He did, and there's no doubt that he made a very significant impact. He was, as you remember, as you mentioned, a founding member of Amnesty International. He became very involved in European organisations as well, because originally, you know, he had been involved in the European Convention for Human Rights and drafting that. He saw Ireland's place very much as in Europe, but he also began to believe in the efficacy and the power of non-government agencies. And he was appointed in 1961 by the UN as their commissioner for Namibia when it came to their dispute with South Africa and their right to self-determination. He was very vocal opponent of capital punishment and very vocal in promoting nuclear disarmament. So he developed an international reputation as a champion of human rights, and has a very significant legacy in relation to that, which was ultimately reflected, of course, in that award 50 years ago.
So it was the work after 61 that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize
very
for.
Much,
is that fair to say?
Yeah, but it's interesting that, you know, at an advanced age, he also came back to the issue of Irish republicanism and the role and of violence. And the idea that paramilitaries will ultimately exhaust themselves into dialogue, which should be encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was reading the situation quite wisely in relation to that. And he also remained quite socially conservative. He campaigned in favour of the Eighth Amendment in 1983. He was still active in 1986 too in opposing the legalisation of divorce. But he had developed that stature as the international statesman, the champion of human rights. And of course, that was something that he was promoting in many of his public appearances as well. And he developed many enemies as a result, because he was calling out state terrorism. He was criticising governments. When he died in 1988, the London Times referred to him as a cosmopolitan high priest of the cult of violence. They never forgot, of course,
the past.
And there was a distrust there of him. But there were many others who were able to pay tribute to the way he used his profile to advance human rights.
Thank you so much. We must leave it there. Dermot Farriter there on Sean McBride.